This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin economist about the recent dip in the stock market, what's behind it, and what it can tell us about the rest of the economy. First, graduation season is in full swing across Wisconsin. We asked graduates of all ages about their visions for the future. Today, we're sharing the hopes of a few college grads around the state.
My name is Mengcha Mua, and today I'm graduating from UW-Eau Claire. It feels very good to be, you know, coming out of it and, you know, doing this accomplishment and being able to walk on stage and be with all my other peers, as well as being without masks and being able to see everyone's happy faces. So after college, I will be going to the University of Washington in Seattle to pursue a master's degree in cinema studies. For me, the future looks like pursuing what you're happy and passionate about. I think we kind of live in a world where people are kind of going the easy route instead of pursuing what they really want to pursue. And pursuing my graduate degree in cinema studies, I'm hopefully paving a path for younger people to also pursue their passions and things that they feel happy about.
My name is Giselle Manette. I am a member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Ojibwe. I'm 23 years old, and I am graduating from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Short term, my goal is to hang out. College was really hard. Wisconsin is a difficult school, so I really want to just read some good books and do kind of monotonous things for a while until I challenge myself again. I'm really interested in health and creating ways to bring in healthy food systems to Native communities. I really hope for a world where all of my brown and black relatives can achieve the levels of health, wealth, and well-being that they desire. I dream of a world that is free of disparity, where people can exist as themselves in the way that they would like to, without judgment and hatred and unjust regulation of their being and their bodies and their existence.
My name's William Kunkel. I'm graduating from UW-Stout with a bachelor's in mechanical engineering. Then after that, I will be pursuing a PhD at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I had a lot of difficulty with school early on in elementary school and middle school, as I'm dyslexic. So eventually I decided school wasn't for me. When you go into higher education, especially pursuing like a PhD, and even at the undergraduate level in college, it's all focused on applications. And I've never had trouble understanding concepts. It's just been the memorization part. My vision is really to work on what I like to think of as tomorrow's problems. The technology that our society can develop is largely dependent on the materials available to us and the manufacturing processes that we have available. So what I'm going to be working on is basically making 3D printing of metals better. So that's how I feel I can impact society by enabling new technologies.
My name is Priyank. I graduated today with a bachelor's in business finance. Well, I'll be starting to work at a Kohler company in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and starting as a financial analyst, which I look forward to. And today was a great accomplishment, but it's just one step into the direction for the future that waits for me. Hopefully, I can leave a good legacy behind me when I'm retiring at age of 60. And, you know, just make an impact into people's lives. Don't be afraid to try new things. Don't be afraid to make a big move. Like Steve Jobs said, stay hungry, strive for greatness.
A big congratulations to all the graduates around the state. You can read more about the people we spoke to at WPR.org. Now, the Federal Reserve today announced the biggest interest rate hike since 1994. It's part of a response to ongoing higher than usual inflation levels, which helped cause a big drop in the stock market on Monday. Monday's drop pushed the S&P 500 into a bear market, meaning it's 20% or more lower than the most recent high. We're talking now about the state of the stock market, inflation, and the Fed's interest rate hike, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the movements of the stock market recently? Do you think about what the stock market is doing in general? Does it have an impact on you? And the Federal Reserve rate hike, do you think it's a good move? How is inflation affecting you in your day-to-day life? Are you having to change what you do because of it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Kevin Barr is chief analyst and professor with the Center for Business and Economic Insight at the UW Stevens Point School of Business and Economics. Kevin, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, thank you very much. Nice to be back.
Let's start with his newest news, this Federal Reserve interest rate hike. I think people knew they were going to do something. What does this mean, the hike that they ended up doing, 0.75 points?
Okay, so I think there's a couple of things behind this. Certainly, it is a fairly large increase, the 75 basis point increase. I think the financial markets were hoping that the Fed would take a sort of relatively large increase as opposed to a smaller increase. And I can see, and I think you can see that by looking at the financial market response today, which is pretty much a strong increase in stock prices, pretty much across the board of about 2%. But all that being said, I think you also have to look at the context. Although this was a relatively historical large one-time increase, that is the 75 basis points, that still only puts the Fed funds rate, their target short-term rate, at between 1.5 and 1.75. So it's basically going to bring that rate back to where it was in 2019. So when we've had this historical or the historically low level of interest rates, really unrealistically low interest rates. So the Fed is going to bring the interest rates probably back up to a targeted rate of about, they're projecting of about 3.4% by the end of this year, 3.8% by the end of next year. So they're going to bring those rates back to where they were historically back in the 1990s and after the turn of the century, pretty much, before you had these sort of traumatic economic events of COVID-19, and then before that, the financial crisis.
And the Fed wants to bring up the interest rates because of inflation. I've asked you this before. Connect the dots. Why does moving this one lever theoretically lead to lower inflation?
Okay, so I think one of the things that's really kind of different right now, you've got, I think, three levers to this inflation. And the Fed can pretty much control one of the three. So the Federal Reserve tries to increase interest rates to lower consumer demand. We've had a very strong economy, a very hot job market. Employment levels have pretty much returned to where they were before the pandemic. The problem is demand's come back, but supply hasn't come back. The Federal Reserve really can't control supply chains. And the other whammy with this is basically energy prices. The Federal Reserve cannot control commodity prices. So what they're trying to do what they can to temper the consumer demand side of the cause of the of inflation. But you got other, you have another two big factors out there, the supply chain and energy prices that the Federal Reserve really can't do anything about.
Finally, we'll get to the thing that we originally called you about, the big market drop on Monday. News keeps happening. The market drop on Monday, that came after the market had gone down. There's this big drop on Monday. Things seem to have smoothed out a little bit. What is going on in the stock market there?
Okay, anytime there's a lot of uncertainty, and right now you have a lot of uncertainty in the stock market, you're going to get a lot of swings, and you might even call it overreaction. I mean, yesterday you had the big drop. Today you have kind of really kind of a big comeback. But you've got uncertainty over inflation. You have uncertainty over energy prices. You have some uncertainty over supply chain issues. I think yesterday you also had some uncertainty over interest rates. I mean, that's kind of gone away a little bit, at least short term, based on what the Federal Reserve did today. So anytime you have a lot of uncertainty, typically, it's not a good thing for the market, and you'll see prices go down. And when some of that uncertainty goes away, like you did today, and the market viewed what the Federal Reserve did, I think, largely favorably, and that's why stock prices pretty much went up.
I like to, when I look at things like this, I like to pull back the timescale some. And in January, at the beginning of this year, we had a record high in the Dow. It, you know, the drop at the beginning of the pandemic, steady climb, record all-time high, 36,000 something at the beginning of the year. Is the story that, oh no, the stock market's plummeting, or is it that was unrealistically high back then given what's going on in the world?
I think you bring up two very good points. I think the stock market was kind of unrealistically high. And I'll talk about that maybe a little bit more in detail coming up here. But I think in addition to the stock market being unrealistically high, if you go back and you went to January, you've got Putin invading the Ukraine. Oil prices, the per barrel price of oil, basically went from $70 in December to near $120 recently. You've had gas prices go up. As oil prices have gone up, gas prices are up about $1.50 this year. I don't think that was really anticipated back in December that you're going to have that kind of a swing in energy prices. And I think for the most part, I think many companies have been surprised by the prolonged supply chain disruptions that they faced. In addition to that, anytime COVID kind of pops up, be it in the United States or in other countries like China, if there's a lockdown in China, that affects supply chains, that affects imports. And it's not only the finished products that would come into the United States, but it's basically inputs that are needed to make other products here in the United States. So I think it's a combination of factors.
Kevin Barr is with us, chief analyst and professor with the Center for Business and Economic Insight at UW-Stevens Point's School of Business and Economics. He's talking to us about Monday's market drop, the interest rate increase from earlier today, and inflation, what it all means for the economy as a whole. You can join in at 800-642-1234. A lot of moving parts here. Do you have thoughts, maybe solutions that you'd like to make the case for some of these problems? Do you have questions about what the heck is going on? And do you personally feel a hit when the stock market drops to your retirement plans, say? Are you feeling the impact of inflation? Is it changing the way you plan, purchase, travel? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with UW-Stevens Point economics professor Kevin Barr, looking at Monday's stock market drop, the Federal Reserve rate increase today, what it all means for the economy and for you. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Chris is with us in Port Wing. Chris, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Chris?
Well, thanks for this important discussion. You know, as a person who's been in investing for retirement for over 20 years in the market, we've been watching what's going on and expecting a market correction, a significant correction, because it's been very, very high. I've been waiting for a correction for 4.5 years. Even if none of these other factors weighed in, I would expect the market to go down significantly. The other thing is we've got to get used to high gas prices. We have to figure out how to price fossil fuels out of the market, and we have to do it without harming poor people. Right now, the market just comes down like a ton of bricks on anybody who doesn't make $50,000 a year or more, and we can figure out how to do this. We need to raise taxes on gas and spend those taxes on compensating people who don't make enough money to afford it, and we need to wean ourselves off these fossil fuels in a way that enhances the economy rather than detracts from it.
Chris, thanks for the call. A couple big points there, Kevin, and actually he brought up something that I put a pin in earlier, the idea that, as Chris says, artificially high markets, he's been waiting for a correction. You said you might have more to say about that.
I think he brought up two excellent points. First of all, as far as the market, the S&P 500, this is kind of your benchmark for large company stocks. Long run average over the last 75 years, the S&P is up typically about 10 and 11% a year. In 2019, it was up nearly 29%, 2020, 16%, 2021, 27%. Those numbers aren't sustainable. The NASDAQ, the technology index, that was just nuts. That was up 35% in 2019, 43% in 2020, 21% in 2021. That's not sustainable. If you look at the U.S. financial markets compared to the world financial markets, the U.S. financial markets outperformed, that is the U.S. equity markets outperformed global markets, and pretty much it wasn't close no matter who you compare us to. Whether you're looking at the Chinese stock market, European stock market, doesn't matter. The U.S. market clearly outperformed. Another great point that he brought up in terms of the gas prices, this might kind of surprise some people, but the gas price in the United States, I've got some data for the end of May. Gas prices for the United States at the end of May were actually lower than the global average. Some of the other gas prices around the world at the end of May, the U.S. average gas price was $4.79. If you look at some of the other countries, Australia was $5.50, China was $5.50, $6.50 in Canada. Over in Europe, pick your country, it's between $8 and $10 a gallon. So the places where it's where it was cheaper is pretty much where you would expect it to be cheaper: Saudi Arabia and Russia, major producers and exporters of oil. So I think those are two great points that the caller brought up.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Melanie next in Middleton. Melanie, hello.
Hello there.
What did you want to bring up, Melanie?
Sure. I think that one thing that's being overlooked is wages. Wages are not keeping up throughout the economy, generally speaking, to inflation. And there's a lot of profiteering I've been reading by major corporations. They're increasing their prices massively, but it's profiteering. It's not necessarily the supply chain or shortages or anything like that. It's just plain old profiteering.
Melanie, thanks for the call. Two big points there. I want to make sure Kevin has time to get to those. Thanks for calling in, Melanie. First of all, wages. We hear about the tight labor market. For some people, Kevin, driving wages up. Melanie worried not fast enough to keep up with costs.
Well, that's definitely true. Wages are up, but real wages, that is after you back out the cost of inflation, for most people, real wages have not kept up. So yes, that is an issue. And I think that's, you know, the Federal Reserve, part of what their actions are trying to do today is to try to bring inflation more in line with wage increases. And that has not been happening recently. Melanie is absolutely right.
And then Melanie's saying, well, yeah, maybe inflation, maybe supply chain. She's also worried that companies are taking advantage of our expectation of high prices to give us high prices.
Yeah, there's a number of things that kind of play into it. I mean, last year you basically had record corporate profits, and you had record corporate profits no matter how you measure it, whether you're looking at absolute dollars or whether you're looking at profit margins. In addition to that, as we've kind of talked about gas prices, stock prices typically reflect expectations of future profitability for corporations. And if you look at the S&P 500, that's pretty much been down, or pretty much down about 20%, not taking into account what happened today, but it's down roughly about 20%. If you look at oil company stocks have absolutely pretty much exploded. Marathon, Valero, Phillips, Exxon Mobil are up 50% year to date, and that's with the overall market being down 20%. So despite the fact, you know, gas prices are high, and Americans are, you know, a lot of Americans are struggling just going to the pump, there's no doubt profits have been quite good for corporations.
Melanie, thanks for that call. Mike joins us next in Spring Green. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. Yeah, financial advisors tell us that we should have a balanced portfolio of stocks and bonds. I guess under the assumption that when stocks go down, bonds go up. And they also advise us as we get older that we should be moving out of equities and into bonds. Are we seeing that in this current situation?
Mike, thanks. Kevin, do we know what bonds are doing as stocks have been dipping?
Okay, well, you've got to be a little bit careful mm-hmm. when you're just looking at bonds, because when interest rates go up, bond prices will go down. So it's sort of like when interest rates go up, you can get nicked on your portfolio, both through stocks and your bond holdings. This is really kind of a pretty complex subject. There's more interest rate sensitivity on long-term bonds than what there is on short-term bonds. There are inflation-protected bonds. There's also inflation-protected savings bonds. If you bought an I bond right now, it's paying about 9.6%. That is an I savings bond. So there are sort of ways that you can do this. But just strictly speaking, if you look at corporate bond pricing and the equity markets, when interest rates go up, you can kind of get nicked on both.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mike. Kevin, big picture. You mentioned gas prices up globally, looking at inflation by country, they're up in most inflation's up in most of the world. how much control do we have in the United States about these things, which at least in part are global issues?
That is a great question, Rob. And I think that's one thing that's not really talked about enough. And that is, okay, yes, the Federal Reserve can control consumer demand in the United States, but gas prices are high around the world. Inflation is pretty much high around the world. Inflation varies. Pick your European country, it varies between about 6 and 20%. Canada's got record high or 30-year high in inflation. They're up around 7%. Inflation is high in Australia. So you've got global factors that have impacted prices and inflation, and those global factors are pretty much its energy prices and its supply chain issues. And that's the type of thing I think you have limited control over. I think right now, quite frankly, oil companies are in a pretty good position, really almost politically, to try to get what they would like to get. I mean, right now, gas prices are extremely high. They can make a lot of profit. And if there's any type of encouragement to try to get oil companies to drill more, they're kind of in a political position to try to get as attractive position as they can to drill more, despite the potential pushback on using more fossil fuels down the road. I mean, what you have here is basically a problem that needs to be solved long term, but you need to do something short term to deal with the problem you got.
Kevin, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Hey, thank you very much, Rob. Been a pleasure. Thanks, callers.
Sure. That's Kevin Barr, Chief Analyst, Business Area Coordinator, and Professor with the Center for Business and Economic Insight at the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point's School of Business and Economics. He talked to us today about the Federal Reserve hiking the interest rates and Monday's stock market drop. Coming up tomorrow here on the Ideas Network, the U.S. House Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol plans a hearing tomorrow. Join us on the Ideas Network or at WPR.org for live NPR coverage that starts at noon. It's one of half a dozen planned public hearings that include witness testimony and evidence surrounding the riot and the lead up to it. Looking back at January 6th of 2021, when supporters of then President Trump stormed the Capitol building in an attempt to halt the certification of the 2020 election. That's NPR special coverage of the January 6th hearings tomorrow at noon here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Social media gets a bad rap sometimes, and maybe for good reasons, but sometimes it gets things just right. Like last night when I looked online for something and I saw a new post from someone in my neighborhood that said, go outside and look at the moon right now. And then I did, and I was really glad because I'd forgotten that this week is the strawberry supermoon. The strawberry part comes from it being strawberry season in a lot of the world, so the moon did not look red like a strawberry. Clear on that. The supermoon part is because the moon is full at the closest point of its orbit to Earth. So the moon looks a little extra big, and if you catch it close to the horizon like I did, a trick of human perception makes it look really big. It peaked this morning. You should still be able to catch it tonight, weather permitting, which it looks like it might not. The supermoon ends when the moon sets early tomorrow morning. If you miss it, there are a lot of great pictures from around the world posted online, and we're in the works for another supermoon next month. Space and social media news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin writer is back from base camp at Mount Everest. He'll share the story of the first all-black American team to reach the top of the legendary mountain. First, when you get invited to a party, how early do you show up or how late? If you get there right when it starts, you might be the first one there. The host might not even be ready. If you're too late, it might seem insulting, or you might miss the fun. Our guest today used his mathematics PhD from MIT to come up with a calculus formula to help us find the ideal time to arrive at any party. It was published in a piece for The Atlantic. Daniel Biss is a former math professor at the University of Chicago. He's also a former Illinois State Representative and Senator, currently mayor of Evanston, Illinois. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
All right, before I get to the formula, if I was to invite you to my house this weekend, say for a cookout, whenabouts do you show up if I say it's at noon?
You know, the problem with writing this this formula is now for the rest of my life, I have no excuse to show up to anything at the wrong time. I think, though, if you were to invite me over for a barbecue at noon, I would probably in real life shoot for arriving around 12:35.
That sounds about right. Okay. Now, Joe Pinsker from The Atlantic got in touch with you with this question. Can you mathify that decision of how early or how late to arrive? How do you mathematically, how did you get started on that?
Well, you know, I mean, first of all, like, let's be real for a second. The answer to the question is no, you can't mathify it in the way that I would recommend adhering to religiously in real life. But I just thought about, you know, what are the questions that you want to ask yourself when deciding when to show up? And some of that is, you know, do your friends tend to be on time? Some of that is, how reliable are your friends, right? Like, maybe your friends are really late. They always show up an hour late, but they always show up exactly an hour late. Whereas my friends might be more on time. On average, they're only 15 minutes late, but you never know. One day they might be right on the button on time, and the next day they might be 2 hours late. So questions like that, how predictable are other people's behavior come into play? And then, of course, there's your own taste. Do you feel real awkward if you're there too early? Do you feel really rude or like you missed out if you're there too late? And you kind of jumble all those things together in a big formula. And we came up with an answer that may not be perfect, but it's probably as good as any.
Yeah. And now you show your work. You've got the mathematical formulas there. I don't think we need to recite them on air. But you have this, there's a thing where there's sliders, and you could say how important to you are those factors you just mentioned, and then calculate. Now, I should show up 58 minutes late. Then after that, it feels late to me. I don't know. How do you judge that? How do you figure out how late is too late, even if the math tells us it's right?
Well, you know, it's like any other real world experiment. If you run the numbers and you show up and you're dissatisfied, then you probably should do something different next time. I think the most important thing in real life is, are you the kind of person who can't stand being late? Or are you the kind of person who can't stand being too early, right? Are you an extrovert who really is fired up for the party? And if you're there, you know, while the host is still in the kitchen preparing stuff and you're just there for a one-on-one conversation, kind of helping make the guacamole, that's terrific because you just want to be around people. Or are you the kind of person who finds that agonizing? And, you know, probably at the end of the day, that's the thing that matters most to most people, is just, what am I looking to get out of this experience?
Now, I know when you went in with the math, obviously this is not a super serious real world problem, but is it fun for you as a mathematician to try to figure out, like, okay, if I was to try to solve this mathematically, how would I do it? Is this a fun way for you to play with math?
It is a fun way. And I think for all of the mountains of grains of salt that you want to take this with, there was something useful in the exercise, right? Because again, in real life, when I go to a party or any social function, I just kind of go. I don't put a lot of thought into how to decide when to leave my house. And by the way, I get it wrong a lot of the time because I don't put enough thought into it. And so one thing that was kind of cool about this project was, by creating a formula, even if the formula isn't necessarily going to be accurate enough to put a person on the moon, I was able to kind of go through the exercise of thinking, well, hold on, what are the different factors I ought to consider? What questions should I ask myself before deciding when to leave? And I did find that not only kind of fun, but also actually a little bit useful just in making plans in the real world.
Now, this isn't the first time you've put math to work on a social question. You helped author John Green with the formula for his book, An Abundance of Catherines, that used math to determine how potential romantic relationships could play out. What did that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I seem to have cornered the beat of making formulas about things you shouldn't make formulas about. So I'm not sure what that says about me. But yeah, John, this was his second novel called An Abundance of Catherines. And it was a really kind of funny, goofy premise. There was this child prodigy high school student who kept dating and getting dumped by girls called Catherine. And he was just sick of having his heart broken by Catherines. And so he wanted to develop a formula using all of his incredible talents that he could use the next time he met a Catherine to figure out if she would dump him or not, so that if the formula said she would dump him, then he could just not go out with her in the first place and avoid the heartache. And so, John asked me to kind of write a real formula. Again, understanding that it's a silly game. It's not, you should not enter into a romantic relationship based upon some formula in a young adult novel that came out 15 years ago. But you know, what would a formula like that look like? What variables would it take into account? What would it, you know, how would it be structured? And it was, you know, it was something that I had a lot of fun writing. And obviously John then became a, you know, hugely popular author. And so now there's people in the world that have that formula tattooed on their arms. And it's, it's a pretty amazing thing.
Now, getting back to the how late or early should I show up at the party? As a guest, I'm kind of in your range. I'll show up kind of late, not crazy late. But as the host, it's like 5 minutes till the party's supposed to start and nobody's there. And I'm assuming that my so-called friends all hate me. Do you have that problem when you host the thing that you have like you reverse your expectations that you would have had as a guest?
Here's the problem, Rob. I have both problems as a host because I am simultaneously not prepared and desperately hoping everyone's late and also convinced they hate me, which is, I think, much more about my own neuroses than any kind of mathematical formula. But
same.
I find that 5 minutes beforehand, I am hoping that there is the worst traffic imaginable because I am not prepared.
Daniel, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's Daniel Biss, mayor of Evanston, Illinois, former math professor at the University of Chicago, with us today exploring how to tackle some of life's problems with math formulas, including how early or late you should show up to a party. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Mary Kate McCoy brings us a story about popular game show host Alan Ludden's Wisconsin roots.
Many know TV personality Alan Ludden for his days as the host of the popular game show Password, or for his marriage to the beloved actress Betty White. Perhaps lesser known is Ludden's Wisconsin roots. Writer Dean Robbins recently stumbled upon his Wisconsin connection during a weekend getaway to Mineral Point.
I recently visited Mineral Point to sample its famous attractions, including the historic mining sites and the 19th century architecture. But during my stay in southwestern Wisconsin, I also stumbled onto a bit of local lore I'd known nothing about. I overheard several conversations about Alan Ludden, the smooth-talking TV game show host of the 1960s and 70s.
Now, here's your host on Password, Alan Ludden.
Well, thank you. Welcome to a special edition of...
And at the Red Rooster Cafe, the small town's popular breakfast spot, my placemat listed Ludden's grave as a Mineral Point highlight. Many tourists might have said, and continued visiting the art galleries on High Street, but not me. I grew up with Ludden's Password, in which contestants traded clues to guess a mystery word. As an elementary school bookworm, I was drawn to a game show host who glorified the English language. We even wore identical horn-rimmed glasses, which made him look dashingly brainy and made me look like the last one you'd pick for dodgeball. While my friends watched cowboy shows, I kept the dial tuned to Password and, no surprise, grew up to be a writer rather than a ranch hand. I'd never thought about it before, but some of the credit goes to Alan Ludden. After a hearty breakfast at the Red Rooster, I searched the internet to explore Ludden's Mineral Point connection. He was born there in 1917, and his father, an ice dealer, soon died of the Spanish flu. When Alan was five, his mother married the guy who ran Mineral Point's electrical plant, after which the family moved around Wisconsin. Alan graduated Phi Beta Kappa from the University of Texas, and then earned a master's in English, suggesting that his intellectual image was not just an act. After receiving a Bronze Star in World War II, Ludden hosted radio and television shows and found his star vehicle at Password in 1961. That's also where he met fellow TV personality Betty White.
Why, Betty White.
Why, Alan Ludden.
Well, it's nice to see you again.
Nice to see you.
What are your plans for the summer, Miss White?
Oh, dear.
They fell deeply in love, married, and worked together on stage and screen until Alan's death from cancer in 1981. White never remarried, saying, "Once you've had the best, who needs the rest?" Ludden was laid to rest in Mineral Point, and townsfolk speculated that his beloved Betty might be buried beside him. To their dismay, she chose not to join him for eternity in Wisconsin, though she did donate his papers to the Mineral Point Library before her own death in 2021. My Alan Ludden journey ended with a pilgrimage to his gravesite on the western edge of town. To its credit, Graceland Cemetery gives no special treatment to Mineral Point's famous son. So, in the absence of signage, I wandered for a while through the sloping grounds. Finally, I found the tombstone, which mentions Alan's service in World War II, but nothing of his showbiz career. Indeed, the peaceful plot feels as far from his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame as you can imagine, bordered by the Iowa County Fairgrounds and rolling farmers' fields. I couldn't help thinking that Betty White might have been quite comfortable there.
Children's author and journalist Dean Robbins brought you that story about the popular game show host Alan Ludden's Wisconsin roots. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, history was made when an all-black team of American climbers summited Mount Everest last month. An outdoor enthusiast and journalist was there at base camp. He walks us through the experience. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A team of climbers made history as they became the first all-black American team to reach the summit of Mount Everest in May of this year. Prior to their trip, fewer than 10 black people had climbed Mount Everest since the first confirmed ascent in 1953. The team, as part of the Full Circle Everest expedition, just about doubled that number. James Mills, a Wisconsin-based writer and author of the book The Adventure Gap, Changing the Face of the Outdoors. He's co-writer and co-producer of the documentary film An American Ascent and founder of the online news site The Joy Trip Project. James works as a journalist and still photographer for the Full Circle Everest expedition and made it to Everest base camp with the team. James, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Thanks a lot for having me. It's good to talk to you again.
Can you tell us a little more about why this is a historic and significant expedition?
Well, I think you said it yourself in your introduction. This is basically a doubling of the number of black climbers that have made it to the summit of Everest. But it's also important to point out that this was the first all-black American team mm-hmm. to summit Everest. And in the process, we actually managed to put the very first black man on the summit. A black American man on the summit of Everest prior to this expedition that had never happened before.
Tell us about the origins of the Full Circle Everest expedition.
Well, I think that we've been working on figuring out how to do something like this for a number of years. My book, The Adventure Gap, talked about the first all African American team to attempt the summit of Denali, the highest peak in North America, in 2014. And in doing so, we were trying to engage and inspire a new generation of particularly young people of color to venture into things like high altitude mountaineering. And over the course of the time since, we've actually been able to get quite a few new climbers coming into the field. And especially with the incidents around 2020, with the death of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor, it was an opportunity for us to put together a very positive story of Black excellence that would hopefully do as we've always tried, and that's to encourage more people who are underrepresented in certain aspects of our society to reach to the highest heights. And what higher height is there than the summit of Mount Everest? And so with the support of a lot of really great companies in the outdoor industry, as well as a lot of private organizations and nonprofits, a group of climbers led by Philip Henderson, who is a former instructor with the National Outdoor Leadership School based in Colorado, got together as many of the people in the African-American community that have taken up climbing over the last many years. And this team came together, a total of two women and eight men, a team of 10, to do the summit attempt. And seven of those 10 climbers made it to the summit.
Can you paint us a picture of what it's like to be at base camp for an attempt at Mount Everest?
Well, I mean, first of all, the walk-in is in itself an adventure, mm-hmm. just in the sense that you're walking through the Khumbu Valley, and it is a very steep uphill climb over the course of almost 2 weeks just getting into position to be able to set up base camp at the elevation of 17,600 plus feet. Once you arrive there, there is basically a tent city. I mean, there are many other expeditions going on at the same time, as well as several scientific expeditions that are installing weather forecasting equipment. And everybody is there essentially to have a experience on the highest mountain in the world. Now, not everybody who makes it to Everest Base Camp actually is interested in ascending to the summit. A lot of people go just to get that far. And the number of people that we met along the way is actually pretty remarkable. People literally from all over the world, from every continent, every nation shows up at Everest Base Camp to, you know, celebrate, you know, mountaineering as part of an expedition tradition.
Now, you and the team have been very careful to acknowledge the Sherpa people and the guides you worked with, who haven't always gotten credit in the history of Everest mountaineering. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, yeah, and that's the interesting thing, too, because, I mean, a lot of people can name Sir Edmund Hillary as the first European to make it to the summit of Mount Everest. But not very many people know the name of Tenzing Norgay, who was right alongside Hillary when he made it to the summit of Everest. By the same token, not very many people know that Jim Whittaker, the first American climber to make it to the summit of Mount Everest, was accompanied by a man by the name of Nawangambu. And that is, again, something that doesn't make it into our history. One of the things that was really important for the telling of this story was to acknowledge that there is no Everest expedition that happens without the cooperation, the support, and the physical labor of Nepali Sherpa people. And, you know, I can tell you that, you know, among our Sherpa team was a gentleman by the name of Amrit Ale, who grew up in the Khumbu Valley and was also a Knowles instructor. And this was his very first climb of Everest. This expedition that will also be made into a film encouraged and supported a four-time Everest summiter, but a first-time Everest photographer by the name of Pemba Sherpa. And many of the pictures that you'll see in many of the magazines of the team were taken by either Pemba or Amrit. And I think that it's really important that we not only talk about the role that Sherpa play in the long history of Everest, but the success of this expedition as a climb that was executed by people of color with the intention of inspiring people of color. We really had positive representation of both the Black American community and the Sherpa community as well.
Now, James, most of us won't end up climbing Mount Everest, but I know from having talked to you in the past, you're really hoping to encourage people who might not think of themselves as outdoor people or might not feel welcome because of their race in the outdoors. You're really hoping to encourage them and make a good world for them to do these kind of things in. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, the purpose of my work, my book, The Adventure Gap, the work that I'm doing currently for National Geographic, with the exploration of a new book that I'm working on that explores Black history as interpreted by the National Park Service. I think it is really important to recognize that, you know, Black Americans, Black people have always played a role in outdoor recreation, have always played a role in the conservation and environmental movement. We need to make sure that that representation is reflected in the people that we see on expeditions, in our national parks, as not only visitors, but park rangers and guides and naturalists and scientists. And expeditions like this basically allows us to now thread a line that goes from the depths of the ocean to the heights of the tallest mountains. And so that people who are interested in this kind of thing can actually see people who look like them as part of the landscape of what outdoor recreation looks like, These are people who will be able to say, wow, that person comes from my neighborhood. That person comes from my community. They go to my church. They're just like me in many ways. That means that I could probably do something like that too. But they don't necessarily have to climb the highest mountain in the world, but they can go to Devil's Lake. You know, they can hike around, Lake Wingra here in Madison, or visit the UW Arboretum, or have experiences in some of our nearby national parks and monuments, specifically the Ice Age National Scenic Hiking Trail, one of 11 scenic hiking trails in the United States.
And we'll have
one more opportunity.
We'll have to leave it there. James, thanks for joining us today. That was James Mills, writer and journalist, author of the book The Adventure Gap, talking about the significance of the first all-Black American team summiting Mount Everest last month and his own experience with that group. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll check out the latest public hearing on the January 6th Capitol attack and the effort to overturn the 2020 elections. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.